when the fracturing of the media landscape or the information ecosystem, let's call it, became so pronounced that people were getting different, not just different versions of the news, but different news. It really made it so difficult to communicate something because there was no baseline truth. And when you're writing comedy, what you're relying on is a common truth, the same point of reference.
Hello and welcome to the Sneaky Art Podcast. I'm your host, Nishant Jain. If you were looking for a conversation about everything, this is the episode for you. I'm speaking with New York-based cartoonist and comedian Jason Chatfield. If that sounds like MSN Messenger came to life and is trying to become your friend, I can confirm that Jason has heard that joke already. Until recently, Jason was the president of the National Cartooning Society in America. Before this, he was president of the Australian Cartoonists Association. They have a gavel in the shape of a giant pencil, but otherwise, I'm told it's very serious business. Before we started recording this episode, Jason insisted that I not keep calling him Mr. President. I can report that since the recording, Jason is no longer president. He left office in disgrace and is presently hiding in the woods in upstate New York. This week, he sent me a drawing of a hen. He says he will be back in 4 years to make cartooning great again. Jason only recently became an American citizen, and a lot of this episode is about growing up, or should I say growing down under, in that strange land far, far away known as Australia. Before the recording, Jason confided in me that he is extremely self-conscious about his ridiculous accent and quite unable to deal with further jokes about his dark past as an Australian. It has taken me a long time to bring this episode to you. Thank you, dear listeners, for being so patient with me. The edit took longer than expected because of Jason's, Australian accent? Portions of this conversation may be extremely difficult to understand, but I hope you find sympathy in your heart for Jason's unfortunate circumstances. I would recommend listening at 0.5x, maybe consider an AI transcription service. This is the first half of a 3-hour conversation that went too fast. Tap the link in the episode description to see my cheat sheet and the real-time notes I made during the recording. As good people, it is incumbent upon us to accept Australians as they are, not how we want them to be. Jason would apologize for himself because he's really quite a nice guy, but he just doesn't have a clue. When he first came to the US, nobody told him because it would be awkward and they wanted to avoid a scene, and now it's just been too long. To break into the scene in New York, Jason did multiple sets of open mic stand-up 6 nights a week for 3 years. 6 nights a week for 3 years. Jason is Australia's most widely syndicated cartoonist, producing the iconic 102-year-old daily comic Ginger Meggs. His cartoons have appeared in The New Yorker. He is the portrait illustrator of the Waking Up app, and he just made a book. Find links to everything he does in the episode description. It seems like Jason does more things every week than I could do in half a year, but I suspect this is a ruse, a trick of some kind, and that really he is 3 separate Australians inside a trench coat. And maybe because this truth is so heartbreaking, I choose to perpetuate the illusion. Jason is amazing, guys. You are going to love this conversation. Enjoy.
It's a pretty intense kind of the whole, I don't know if you've done San Diego Comic-Con, but it
is. I have
not. It's a lot. Like, it's very exhausting. It's a lot of people every day. 120-something thousand people every day. And it's it takes it out of you. So I'm recovering. I'm in recovery.
Tell me about it. Like, I read your post, of course, and I saw that
You were selling your book, your new book, which you sold all the copies of. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And there were no stars there because of the strike. So it was a very different kind of Comic-Con. What was your experience?
It was a different kind of Comic-Con. I've been going, that's my 15th Comic-Con.
Oh, wow.
In the last, like, I want to say 10 years. It was so different without people lining up for Hall H, you know, for the big Star Wars and Marvel, DC, you know, the presentation. So people actually started paying attention to the artists, the comic artists at Comic-Con, God forbid. So it was really nice. And yeah, and this is the first year I had something to sell other than just like commission. Usually I just do drawing commissions for people, quick sketches and things. But this year, obviously, I have the book out, You're Not a Real Parent Until. So people came by, a lot of parents came by, and then they'd sort of see it, and I'd get to up close watch the moment that they sort of flick through it and actually hear laughs. Usually I have to wait till I'm on stage to hear laughs, but it was amazing to see like people read a thing you made and then laugh out loud. And so I can sort of see the moment, and then they'd like snap the book shut, pass it over to me, go, all right, I'll have two. I've got a brother-in-law. He's expecting a kid, you know. It was nice. Yeah, that part was nice.
And is this your first time selling a book at a stall?
It is. Do you have any tips?
Well, when you were just saying that, you know, them flipping through the pages, I was reminded of my self-published book. So I just self-published when I was living in Wisconsin.
Mm.
And I sold it at the farmer's market every Saturday of summer.
Right.
And I would set up a stall from 6 a.m. until noon. And then I would try to entrap these people who are going to buy veggies and milk and tell them, you know, you should buy a book instead.
I read some of your posts on that. I read some of your things on that about the farmer's market. It is interesting, the dynamics of interactions with people, like in real life. It fascinates me how people... once they see the person behind the thing, rather than just seeing it on a shelf, it's a totally different proposition for them. They have a more organic interaction with the thing.
Yeah.
And as you know, you get very precious about your creation sometimes. I try not to be. I try to be as dispassionate as I can, but you put so much work into a book that you just really want people to enjoy it. And it's nice when they like it, but it's also like you're really putting yourself out there. I admire your hustle going out to the market, because that's...
This episode is about admiring your hustle, because you've been like, I've been reading about the kind of stuff you've been into since you arrived on North American shores. And it is frankly insane to me that how much work you've done. So we're going to focus on that.
Okay.
But just to fill you in, I was living in this little town called Eau Claire in Wisconsin. And this is a town of just less than 100,000 people.
Wow.
And I was just starting to be an artist. And I was at this sort of, not an identity crisis, but what I was trying to do was in flux in my mind, because I had just left my previous life to be a writer instead. And I was also a comic artist, so I wanted to make more comics, but America and just generally being so far away from the place that I made comics about, because I used to make comics about Indian life and Bollywood and cricket. Mm-hmm. And all of those things were very, very far away from my world. And I felt like I wasn't being very authentic. So I, for various reasons, among this reason, I started drifting away from comics at that time, and I started just drawing. And then that became sneaky art. And then I became quote unquote artist. And so this was my first time being very declarative about this, that, okay, I'm an artist and I'm going to own that title and I'm going to introduce myself as that and let's see what happens. And then I did that for a year, and the next year I sold a book. And exactly to your experience, you know, like watching somebody look through your art or your drawings or the book you made, and they're flipping through the pages in front of you, and then their eyes light up at a certain page. And I always want to know, okay, which page did that? How did it happen? And what is it that they connected with? Because, you know, you can't control. So, of course, we should talk about this, because you do this from so many different media.
Mm.
You can't control how people sort of bring your art into their world. It becomes sort of their thing once it's in their ecosystem, you know, like they relate to your jokes a certain way.
Yeah.
Your comics that you draw, they will put people from their life into it, into those figures. And then it's their joke in a sense. And so you never know what clicks with them and why. And it might be something that you wouldn't think would work in that manner, but it just does for them.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. And you also, there's an old saying, I don't know who it is attributed to, but the saying is the reaction doesn't belong to you. Mm-hmm. And I think I remember maybe Austin Kleon or someone like that talking about the fact that once you put your art into the world, it takes on a life of its own. You technically have no control. You have control over some things, but certainly not the interaction that it has. And it grows its own sort of life, you know, it builds its own ecosystem almost. Like the reaction that it has, whether it's good or bad, is sort of up to the audience, up to the, you know, wherever it lands. And sometimes that can be the most terrifying part, and exhilarating as well. The terrifying part of putting your art into the world is just not quite knowing how or where it is going to land with people. And that was a very big lesson I had to learn, is just stop trying to control the reaction, because you can't.
I was going to ask you about that. Like, do you also have the instinct to want to control this thing, or have you been sort of more comfortable with, how has this process been of, you know, letting go of, once you've created the thing, now it's out there and now I don't control it?
That's such a good question, because it's something I've been wrestling with for years. Because I'm a perfectionist, right? So, which is not a good thing. That's a very bad thing. I had to get counseling for it. Like, I went to a psychologist for it because it was crippling. And as you probably know, it's one of those things where you could tweak and change and rework and overwork something for sometimes years if you don't have a deadline, or if you're not going to just, you know, relinquish it from your clutches and let it just go out into the world. And often I just would be so paranoid about how it could be in my head versus how it came out on the page. And that dissonance between what's in here and what came out of my hands, it can be a really difficult skill to build. Let's call it resilience. Let's call it an acceptance, almost like a Buddhist kind of acceptance of what is rather than what you intended.
Yeah.
It's part of the reason I now use a flex nib with dip pen and ink. It's one of the most chaotic and uncontrollable ways of, and I'm sure we'll geek out about fountain pens later, but of creating art. And I am seeding, as in CEDE, seeding the control of what comes out to the nib in many ways, as a way for me to just accept that I have less and less control over what's up here versus what comes out of here. I know there are artists like Jeff Smith who does Bone, and artists who have such an incredible, like Peter DeSev, and even like Richard Thompson, who looked chaotic, but it was controlled chaos. They have an ability to control what they want to control, and you can see it, but they're not sort of preoccupied with that process, which, yeah, as I say, perfectionism sounds like a good trait. It's not. It's a very bad trait for an artist to have, because you never ship anything.
I absolutely agree. Like, I feel like I've also been a perfectionist for too long, and I picked up the fountain pen for the same reason. Like, I tell people that a lot of people assume that I draw with a fountain pen because I'm just good at drawing, or because I already knew how to draw and so it was easy for me to do this. But I remind them that I started drawing with the fountain pen before I knew how to draw, and I did it just so that I could learn without erasing, without constantly editing and checking and changing and being disappointed. This dissonance between the image in your mind or the idea in your mind and how, you know, there's always a sense of disappointment, if at least with certain works. Like, you also express yourself in different ways. You have the spoken word, you have your drawings, and you have words that you write. But so I think you're able to understand this, that there is this almost a disappointment in all the things it could be, and then the one thing that you decided it is, and the one thing that it ended up becoming. And this disappointment you can't really share with anyone because it's always only going to be inside your head, that pristine image. Mm-hmm. So nobody quite gets your frustrations. And in my case, it's taken me, like, I'm a little forgiving with my art. Like, yeah. I like it more in the a week later.
Yeah.
I sort of separate myself from those other ideas that I had in my mind of what I wanted it to be.
Wow.
But I'm still really unforgiving with my writing. And everything I write, every single post I've ever written, when I look back at it, I want to change like half of it.
Yeah. To hit publish is a real ordeal for me. Because I consider myself a bit of a dilettante when it comes to writing, I have so much to learn. And I feel like a complete fraud every time I hit publish, just because I want to rewrite it. I want to rework it. I want to go back and change everything. And then a week later, I'll look at it and go, that sentence structure is a nightmare. And it's similar to the drawing. I sometimes just have to see that, all right, you have until 9 a.m. and you have to hit publish. It's the SNL thing. It's you don't go live. We're not going live because we're ready. We're going live because it's 11:30. That's what Lorne Michaels used to say.
Interesting. Yeah. I think that sort of philosophy, that sort of idea is so useful. Like, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yes.
It's so important to just ship things, to get things out, and then get into this idea that no single product is supposed to be perfect, because I think perfection also implies that you're sort of done.
Yeah.
What would you do after you're perfect already? And this, like, it makes me wonder where this idea of perfectionism came from. Like, it's so obvious that you shouldn't be perfectionist and that it stops you from creating.
Mm-hmm.
But nearly every artist you meet, or especially a lot of the people who struggle with art or writing or any kind of creative expression, and then they give it up, it's usually because they couldn't be perfect in the way they wanted to be. And even after centuries of knowing that this is not the way to get things done, we still want to be perfect.
I think it's intrinsic. I think it's in us. I think it's just something that you're not taught. You have to be extrinsically, you have to be told from outside that it is an unrealistic expectation for something to be perfect. There are two people who really helped me when I was literally getting counseling for it. One of them was Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal, wrote a book called The Gift of Adversity. And in it, there's a chapter called The Thumbs Must Go, where when he was a kid, they had to do this activity where they cut out like this clown or something from paper, and they had to sort of pin it together with sort of moving hands and fingers, and to cut with scissors out the hand shape, it was going to take too long for him to do by the time they needed to turn it in.
Yeah.
So he ended up just cutting off the thumbs. And the thumbs must go. And the whole thing looked fine. No one noticed. Only he noticed the thumbs weren't there. No one made a comment. He got full marks for the project. But in his head, it just started this thing of, you know, once in a while, you might just have to concede that something's not going to be exactly perfect for the sake of it just being and exist and going into the world. The other one is a guy called Oliver Berkman. He wrote a book called 4,000 Weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Just brain-changing book. One of those few books like Atomic Habits or something that changes your entire mind. He has a great newsletter called The Imperfectionist.
Okay.
It comes out once a month. Highly recommend. And he has so many great tools to let you let go of that, as you say, completely unnatural, unhealthy tendency for everything to be perfect, which is so counterintuitive. And it's sort of consciously rewiring your expectations so that when you do sit with a notebook, you're not crippled by what, you know, the fear that it won't come out the way you want it to come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I always tend to forget this. Let me rewind a bit and sure. formally, quote unquote, introduce you.
Sure.
So, good morning and welcome to the Sneaky Art Podcast, Jason. Thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm a fan, I'm a premium subscriber, and I feel like I almost know you already.
So, Jason, I grew up reading daily comic strips in the newspaper. That's the first place that I realized that this is a form of communication that, you know, it can say so many different things. So the newspaper that we would get in my hometown of Calcutta in India, it had syndicated comic strips from, I think, many different places and many different eras. So some of them were from the 70s, some from the 80s and 90s. And every Sunday there would be a color comic strip, which was always the Calvin and Hobbes. And the rest of the weekdays, it would be black and white stuff. And I would have Luann and Hagar the Horrible and Dennis the Menace and a Phantom comic as well and a Spider-Man comic. So now that I look back on it, it's so interesting how many different moods they were trying to satisfy. There was action, there was thriller, there was comedy, there was just life. And there was Dennis the Menace, which is just a single big panel of silly things next to the crossword. But I have never heard of Ginger Meggs. So please tell me everything about Ginger Meggs. Tell me about what are Australian comic strips like? Are they fundamentally a little different? Are they upside down? I don't know anything about Ginger Meggs at all.
It's like every Canadian comic strip starts with, I'm so sorry. So it's interesting that you say that you grew up in Calcutta and were reading comics that were ostensibly English speaking, like expat American comics. Ginger Meggs, the comic strip that I do, is basically an Australian Dennis the Menace, but it predates Dennis by about 40 years. He started in 1921. It's what is known as a legacy strip, which means I'm the fifth cartoonist in about 102 years to write and draw the strip. It's always a one-man show for Ginger Meggs. He's kind of a red-headed larrikin kid. The word larrikin, I realize, doesn't translate great. He's like a rascal, he gets troublemaker, rascal, rapscallion kind of kid. A larrikin is an Australian term, and it's a very nationalistic kind of thing where Australians identify as larrikins, you know. Healthy.
I should remind my listeners that we're speaking in a foreign language today.
Yeah, and cricket. I mean, even cricket is its own language. So I grew up watching cricket. Ginger Meggs, the strip, often has him playing cricket. In fact, the very first strip in 1921 that featured Ginger Meggs, the strip was called something else back then. It was called Us Fellows. And it was him playing cricket and hitting a ball through a neighbor's window and sending the pretty girl, Gladsome Gladys, to go and fetch it from the angry guy whose window they just broke so that he wouldn't yell at her. And it was taking it over. I took it over when I was 23. And I had been a big fan of the comic strip. And I've been doing it for 16 years. So it's one of those mediums, as you say, it sort of transcends, because it's a very visual medium, it transcends a lot of language barriers, but it also is a very effective way to communicate ideas, humor. It's used in especially what is known as sequential art, so comic art. Anyone who wants to really go down that rabbit hole can read Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics, which is basically deconstructing the entire medium down to why it works as well as it does. Ginger Meggs, he runs in the Hindustan Times, by the way.
Interesting.
Yeah, but a lot of expat Aussies in India read him in the Hindustan Times, but it's also mainly because of the cricket content. So I do 6 daily strips a week, which are those sort of thin 4-panel ones that you would have been reading in the daily. And then the big Sunday strip, I do one of those every week, which is, you know, like the Calvin and Hobbes one you were talking about. And I know this is an audio podcast, but Nisha, I'm going to show you my most prized possession on my wall.
Oh my God.
It's the final Sunday strip that Bill Watterson did of Calvin and Hobbes, signed by Bill Watterson.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I need to visit your home because I would steal that.
Yeah. I got a lot of cartoons on my wall, but that one is my pride and joy. It was a gift from my syndicate who syndicates Ginger Meggs to about 34 countries. They translate it into different languages and things. But it's the same syndicate that syndicates Garfield and Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side and all those comics. And Luann, you know, that's another one. Greg and Karen Evans are very close friends of mine, and they They'd be interested to know that, you know, you're growing up in Calcutta reading Luann, which is such an American cricket.
Oh, yeah. But like Luann, I remember her brother was a distinct character, and there was some guy who used to, who had a crush on her, but she didn't, like, I think Gunther or somebody.
Yeah. Unrequited love. Yeah.
Yeah.
All of those themes are so, I guess, universal, but it's, you know, I always get surprised when I see international comics pages. I was flying through Fiji one time and I stopped to pick up the Fiji Times, and Ginger Meggs was in there. And the other comics were like The Phantom and Garfield, obviously, because Garfield seems to be in every newspaper. But there were some strips that I'd never heard of that were under there. And then like Modesty Blaze, you know, like,
oh yeah, Modesty Blaze too. Strips.
Yeah. Yeah,
I remember that.
And I still, you know, internationally, I still self-syndicate to some papers. Like, so I talk to the Fiji Times and I sort of ask them, you know, sometimes like, hey, do you ever get any feedback? And they write, like they put on their blog and everything, like certain strips that resonated, and they'll talk about them. Because Australian comics, getting to your question, they are distinctly Australian in that A, the characters and the settings are unique, and B, our sense of humor is distinct from, say, American or British or any, like, I have friends, by virtue of growing up in Perth in Western Australia, a lot of my friends were from Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, because it's like, it was like 3 hour flight to Bali. That's where we went on vacation, because it was 5 hours to Sydney or 3 hours to Bali. So we're going to Bali. It was an interesting mix in school. One of my best friends was from India, and it was interesting sort of seeing, how the Australian sort of, let's call it culture, the Australian culture sort of meshed with that multicultural input, because they were all first generation immigrants, and it was like seeing the contrast was, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know, you have no context for that, but as an adult you look back and go, oh wow, like I now understand what a huge, and also as an immigrant now I realize what a huge change it must have been. And so to that end, the Australian cartoons and comic strips do have something that is fairly, I want to say esoteric. I want to say like, it's very, there's some language that would really only tracks in Australia.
Yeah.
Even the word, like, you know, larrikin.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are just certain things that there's like a subtext or a shorthand that we all have, you know, which actually works against us in many cases. So when Ginger Meggs was syndicated internationally, the editors had to change much of the localized references to make them comprehensible to international audiences. It does get translated into like French and Spanish and different, I think Bahasa and different languages. And sometimes the translations do not work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many threads there to go down. I'm going to pick one at a time randomly. Okay. One of them was, you said expat American comics. So I never thought of syndication as a way to reach your audience that lives in another country. Help me make sense of this. How does this work? And how does, like, is it usually syndicated to countries where there are expat Australians and they know there's therefore a market for it? Is that it?
Yes. So, for instance, Ginger Meggs appears in the Bangkok Post. And there, it runs as a daily and as a Sunday strip. And I went there to meet with the editor and the some of the staff at that newspaper. And they said that they do like a survey of almost like a census of like who's reading it and where and how. And they said so many expat Australians living in Thailand were reading that paper, which is why they wanted Ginger Meggs. And yeah, it was interesting to get that sort of insight, because when I took over the strip, it was already running in Thailand and I didn't realize. And then I sort of went through the whole list of where it was appearing and was like, oh, I didn't think there would be any audience there. And then they explained it to me. They're like, no, no, there's a lot of expats here who find a relationship with something like a book or like an author or a journalist or a comic strip or something that reminds them of home, or that connects them with their home country. And yes, it is a medium that that finds its audience wherever it is. And the newspapers and the syndicates do their diligence on like demographics of readership and all that. Otherwise, they, you know, I mean, they wouldn't run the strip. I mean, it's a wasted effort if no one's reading it. So they do the back end on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And with legacy comics, like Ginger Meggs has been around for over 100 years now. And, you know, I think it's the same with Dennis the Menace. Mm-hmm. And it was the same. It's also the same with all of these syndicated comics that run over decades. Is there is this sense of timelessness that they maintain, mm-hmm. and in order for, you know, those key markers to be hit and for it to continue to hit the same market and the same general demographic over mm-hmm. decades. And it's interesting to me. Like, tell me a little bit about how. So coming into it as a 23-year-old and mm-hmm. taking over this thing, which is. Been around for decades and decades and is such a big part of the culture.
Yeah.
What are the obligations on your end to help, you know, steer the ship and manage it in the direction that it's been going? Like, for example, can Ginger Meggs have a smartphone?
So the obligation that I had was enormous because it over time, just by virtue of just existing for so many decades, it sort of vacuumed up the zeitgeist of each decade in Australia and ended up becoming kind of a time capsule of Australian culture, because it is such a young country and our culture is still evolving. So it became this sort of bellwether for how Australians speak and think and what our values are. And that's a huge responsibility to take on. But I also was very aware that I didn't want to include anything political because it is escapism. Same with my stand-up. I don't get political. I want people to be able to just sit and enjoy and, you know, just not have to think about all the other stuff which is going on in the rest of the world or the newspaper. And that's sort of, yeah, it was a big, big, difficult job to both steer this old steamship in the wind towards a more modern audience, to try and find the readers where they were going, because they were migrating away from newspapers when I took it over. Mm-hmm. And it was a giant, when I took it over in 2007, it was right before a giant migration from print to online, which I needed to sort of be there when they arrived, when the readers arrived. So, you know, I was on Tumblr and Twitter and Facebook and remember Tumblr. I was sort of trying to make sure that I was covering all my bases for that while still maintaining the integrity of the strip. And it's a really delicate balancing act because you don't want to alienate your readership, who are very loyal and very protective. But you also don't want to stagnate and just become sort of the museumify the strip, you know, have it sort of just become this stale, irrelevant thing. So I had to kind of do a bit of both. You're trying to cater to both audiences, which is you're doing this tap dance, this constant, one foot in both pools. It's tough. I did give him a smartphone eventually. I took a long while because he's quite a poor kid. He's not in a upper middle, he's a scrapper, right? Mm-hmm. So he's always trying to make things happen and hustle and kind of set up a lemonade stand or sell all his dad's shoes or something to make a few bucks to buy some movie tickets to impress the girl that he likes, you know. And he builds his billy cart out of the wheels from his bin, you know. Like, it's just he got a phone because it was a hand-me-down.
Right.
And he got it quite late. Everyone else, all his other friends had a smartphone first. His rich friend, Fitzy, he was the first to have a smartphone. And once I brought that in, got a bit of pushback from readers going, oh, come on, you know, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, look at your grandkids. Look at your kids. What are they doing right now? They're staring at a tablet. They're staring at a phone. Like, to not put it in would be a very conspicuous, you know, absence. And one of the other big things that I did, and I have to tell you, this was the most challenging part of, the most challenging part, and this is not necessarily a reflection of the myopia or xenophobia that was sort of inherent in Australian culture. It's been a very weird time for Australia because it's quite a conservative country and it's had some conservative governments, and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of the politics in Australia. What I did was I asked some of my friends who were living in Australia and wanted to be able to sort of see themselves and their kids in comic strips. I was like, okay, so what do we do? How do I slowly and not tokenistically work in some new characters so that the strip actually looks like modern Australia? Because when it started in 1921, everyone was white, everyone was spoke English, everyone, you know, thought the same way and ate the same foods. But I brought in a part Indian, part Sri Lankan character. And again, had to sort of consult with friends who grew up in those countries and had mixed families. So even the dynamics of the parents and what the last name would be based on the families and what they would eat, what they would like, how they would speak, but how they would speak living in Australia. So right. Bringing their culture and their traditions in without it looking like we're being, you know, disrespectful. So that was Rahul Jayasinghe, my friend Dilruk Jayasinghe. He's a comedian in Australia. He helped me develop that character and the background of that. And I gave the character his last name. And then my friend Ronnie Cheng is a comedian. He helped me develop Penny Cheng, who is a Malaysian Australian. Her mother came from Malaysia as a single mother. And again, you know, trying to reflect the realities of what a family looks like now. Not everyone is married. Not everyone is raising a child, you know, co-parenting. And bringing in these characters without making them tokenistic or cliched, you know. We brought in an Indigenous Australian character, Gloria Tudorhope. And she, again, we consulted with, you know, Indigenous Australians to make sure that we weren't being offensive or tokenistic or anything like that, and making sure that she didn't like, she wasn't, you know, this totem for any, like she plays the violin and she loves running. Like there's nothing stereotypical about her. But she does share sort of parts of her culture through her character. So bringing those in took about 10 years. That was a very slow burn. And again, wanting to modernize it while still remaining respectful for the source material, it was a huge, delicate balancing act.
Oh yeah. Like I'm just thinking about how a lot of these comics, like even Dennis the Menace, for example, it has this sense of an idyllic suburban life. And those ideas have changed. And the audience, the market that's, you know, the majority of the market that's going to consume these comics today, maybe does not identify with that world or that life or those aspirations. Mm-hmm. And even the idea of introducing a non-white character, like, someone might think it's not so difficult, but I'm thinking about the super popular and it's made so much money, this TV show, A Big Bang Theory.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Its Indian character is basically no ethnicity. Like his name doesn't make sense. And the one time they showed his parents, it just didn't make sense that they would look like this considering his name. And, wow. You know, like they mixed up ethnicities big time and they just did not, like, accents and references, none of it made sense. It was just like, wow. Indian is just this one little city somewhere and they've all come out of this one little city and they're behaving like that. It was so awkward.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this challenge is immense. And I'm thinking, you said that the creator of Ginger Megs is always just one person and you're 23 when you take it over. Is it much easier or is it much harder to do things, to take on such a big responsibility and be in charge of it and you're a 20-something?
Yeah, I mean, it was overwhelming. I initially was going to say no when it was offered to me. My predecessor on the strip, James Kemsley, he was dying of motor neuron disease and we thought we had more time. And he was going to sort of train me up and sort of show me how it's done. Cause I'd never done a daily comic strip before. I was doing editorial political cartoons and caricatures and illustrations. I hadn't actually done a strip. So, he said, you know, it's a big responsibility, but I think you're right for it. I think I can see that you would be good for this. I couldn't see that in myself. He was 59. He had sort of consulted with a lot of other cartoonists about who he should approach to take over the strip. And apparently they would, well, my name came up every time, which is odd to me because I did not think I was a good fit. I really was going to say no. And then it took some convincing. I talked to a lot of different cartoonists and people who were familiar, like Gary Clark, who did a strip called Swamp, and Tony Lopez, who does a strip called Insanity Streak, or in the UK, it's called Odd Streak. And they were really helpful in sort of kind of informing my decision to say yes and to actually think that I might do a good job of it. And I still, to this day, I'm very grateful to them because they were the people who helped me arrive at accepting it and then taking on that huge challenge of keeping it going, but then also moving it forward. I have to say that newspapers have sort of had their day, and that's an unfortunate sort of thing. A lot of them are just getting sort of gobbled up by hedge funds and firms that sort of buy them and pull them apart for scrap and sell them. And then like centralize everything. So there's no more local news, which I think is why things like Substack do so well, is that you can find your niche and you can cater to your audience very specifically in a way that a local newspaper used to be able to do. But yeah, it feels like over time, from the time I took on the strip to now, the daily newspaper is just kind of a relic. It's a sad truth, but it just kind of has become less of a ubiquitous source of information and community, and more of just kind of this, oh, what's that? Oh, it's a newspaper. That's interesting. It's weird to see someone reading a newspaper.
That's so true. Like, and it's fallen away from use, and you wonder what is the cause and what is the effect. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, because
it is.
I mean, it's so easy to point to online sources of news and social media as the reason for the decline of newspapers. And obviously that is also true. But I used to be very politically aware. Like, I used to make political comics, and following political news and political humor was so important to me. I used to do that day and night. So a part of what I saw, at least in Indian media, was that the newspapers weren't really looking forward. And that did not help the situation where you are facing a deficit of trust from your community because there's misinformation going around. And now suddenly people have more options. Like, there were multiple newspapers to choose from in my hometown. But online suddenly makes it a different ball game.
Yeah, no, it's a conversation I have, just, it seems like, on repeat for the past 5 years at least, of where it begins and ends as far as cause and effect. And I have to say that when the fracturing of the media landscape, or the information ecosystem, let's call it, became so pronounced that people were getting different, not just different versions of the news, but different news. Mm-hmm. It really made it so difficult to communicate something because there was no baseline truth. And when you're writing comedy, what you're relying on is a common truth. You're relying on people having the same point of reference. And what I mean by that is, you know, it was much easier when there was consensus comedy, which is like Johnny Carson getting up and saying, hey, did you see this commercial the other day? Or hey, just what about this politician? Because everyone was getting the same news.
Everyone has got the same culture feed, in a sense.
Like, yeah, same points of reference, same cultural feed. And in a large part, that was actually bad, because it meant that whatever that was curated to was all you got. But on the other side, you know, it helped people to understand certain fundamental things and communicate in such a way that they were talking about the same thing. Now people seem to be talking past each other. Mm-hmm. And it's why I don't do political cartoons anymore. I did them for 15, 16 years. And I really don't do them much anymore at all. If I do them, I'll do them for the New Yorker, but they're less sort of incendiary takes on politics and more sort of observational social outcomes based on political events. And it's more like when you're writing jokes for people, or writing comedy for stage, or for, you know, the New Yorker for gags, or for the comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
You're really keeping your audience in mind and what their frames of reference are generationally and informationally, like what their sources of information are. Like the people I write the comic strip for, the demographics are 40 to 80. They read the newspaper and they watch the nightly news. Like that's their information diet. And, you know, they might subscribe to some newsletters on their phone or their desktop, but for the most part, they're getting a traditional, let's call it a traditional media diet. And then for my Substack, I know that it's a totally different audience again. And then for stand-up, it's 18 to 34 and it's people who go out on a weeknight and they may or may not have kids. You know, they have certain values. And then when you go on the road, which was a real eye opener when I started doing that in America, it's different again, because you're not in a blue bubble in a city like New York. You're now speaking to people with different values and different, points of reference and, sort of even structurally, you know, like a town versus a city, the way you speak about things needs to either adapt to be sort of comprehensible to them, or you need to not change it so that it's a novelty to them. They're like, huh, this crazy guy from New York, I can't believe he thinks that. It's like, you have to kind of pick one. You either want to be a chameleon and try and fit, or you really double down on what's unique about you and you make yourself a bit of an odd duck. I do the latter now. I used to do the former and sort of code switch. Now I just go, you know what? I'm weird. Just deal with it.
I resonate with so much of that, especially how, you know, stand up, from how you describe it, it seems so much about meeting your audience where they are. Mm-hmm. And it appears to me that newspapers, back when it was just newspapers and this single channel of communication, one-way communication for the most part, it was like newspapers and comic strips by extension had the mandate on defining how things are. And now you have to meet your audience and you have to speak to your audience rather than speak to the thing. And you have to make, like, because your audience has a stronger sense now of how things are and they don't really want to accept another version. Is that the case? Have you found it that way? Because I used to draw political comics up until 2017, but I completely stopped it because, like how you describe, I found that people live in different worlds and I'm trying to talk to them from my world and they don't agree with the basic rules or the basic situation of my world. And I'm getting into these strange, dissonant arguments with people and we're not even talking about the same things, or our words mean entirely different things to us.
You're talking past each other. Yeah.
Talking past each other. So there's this, there's this really beautiful, little bit of stuff that I learned from this philosopher called Derrida. Have you heard of Jacques Derrida?
No. How do you spell that?
So Derrida is spelled D-E-R-R-I-D-A. So he was this.
No, I haven't. No.
So he was this French deconstructionalist philosopher, and he was a rabble rouser. So he would provoke people. He was a provocateur, and. Mm. He said this thing, he said, there is nothing outside the text. And he said this other thing, which I really love, which I contrast with this statement. He said, every statement is a lie. So firstly, there is nothing outside the text and every statement is a lie. So how do you live with those two things? There's nothing outside the text says that if you don't have the words for it, there is no way for you to explain the thing. And therefore, it doesn't exist. So if it doesn't exist in the sense of it doesn't. So let's think about something like, say, PTSD or even perfectionism or depression. Yeah. Until these words were given to it and these descriptions were formed and people had a sense of what PTSD might mean, what depression might mean, even if they're slightly wrong, but they have a sense of it. Compared to 500 years ago or 1,000 years before when they didn't have the words for it, how did they grapple with it? How did they understand it? And what are the words they then put to it to try to understand it? And how their world was limited by essentially the vocabulary. These are the words with which I'm able to understand my world, and there is nothing outside the text.
Wow.
So this is one part of it. The second part, which is really makes it fascinating to me, is how every statement is a lie, and which is sort of what you're talking about. So he said that words have two, at least the big words, they have two kinds of meanings. So think of big words like love or justice or punishment or democracy or freedom. Words have synchronic meanings and diachronic meanings. A synchronic meaning is what you believe the word means now, today. And diachronic meaning is the long history of definitions it has had over the centuries. And even esoteric definitions, but also commonly accepted mass ideas of what justice means. So again, a few decades or a few centuries ago in some places, justice means an eye for an eye. And if somebody kills somebody, it is justified that someone would take revenge for it or someone would kill them in turn for it. And how our definition of justice has evolved over time has changed. And so the word justice, the word democracy, the word crime, the word ruler or leader, and all these ideas around it have these long history of meanings in different parts of the world. And sometimes when we're talking to people, actually Derrida would say every time we talk to someone else, we are using our meanings and they are using their meanings. So every statement is a lie because what they hear from you is never what you're saying.
I should apologize to the listener if their head just exploded because that is extraordinary. I've never heard of Jacques Derrida. I hadn't heard. It makes perfect sense that the meaning of something would evolve over time based on the evolving context. And I think when it comes to art, when it comes to like what something means, in a certain period of time versus it being translated or interpreted decades or even centuries hence, it's like hieroglyphics. And I mean that metaphorically, like the hieroglyphic nature of like what we're saying and what it means may well not be what it is translated as, you know, by future generations.
Generations separated from the culture. And I've thought that literally about hieroglyphics before, that what if we have a completely different understanding of, you know, certain parts. Like, of course, the more I learn about linguistics and archaeology, the less likely it seems. But my raw amateur idea was, what if someone was just doing graffiti and we read it and we think of it as completely serious and, you know, everybody in the past is being very straightforward, or you know, they're not using metaphors, they're not as complicated as us, they don't use sarcasm the same way as us. Of course, this is not the case. Historians are adults and educated and intelligent, and they account for these things. But this is what I thought about how easy it is to misinterpret something so casual.
But you studied law, right?
No, I studied engineering.
Oh, engineering.
Yeah,
right.
I am an Indian person, and most of us do this thing of studying completely things unrelated to our interests. And I studied to be an engineer, and I went too far with it. I got a master's degree. And,
oh, my God.
Then I was in the middle of a PhD program. I was going to be a neuroscientist, and then I quit in order to be a writer. And today we are talking about all of this stuff, and here I am.
I did know the part that you got to PhD. I didn't know that it was in engineering. I thought it was in law or something. I do know that you made that switch to being an artist from that PhD, and I was like, wow, what happened? But it was more of an enlightenment than I hate engineering. There are two things that I hopefully have time to talk about it. I'm not on a deadline, but I don't know what you're...
Absolutely not on a deadline.
Oh, great. Okay. So just sort of expounding on what you said about Derrida's sort of point about deconstruction and interpretation, there are cartoons in the collections of, say, the New Yorker, or there was a magazine called Punch in the UK for many years.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the New Yorker equivalent in the UK. And I often go through those to look at like what they were laughing at and what the points of reference are, but the interpretations of the joke, many of them are totally over my head. And not because I'm an immigrant, like the UK ones and the US ones, they're completely indecipherable. I don't get the joke. I don't get the reference. I don't even understand some of the language they're using. And to them, and this is only like three generations ago, or two generations ago. And I'm looking at it going, what the hell does that even mean? Was that a meme? Like, was that their equivalent of a meme back then? Right. Because I think about political cartoons. You know, in history, you study the text, but then sometimes you'll study the political cartoons at the time, say, for instance, World War II. Mm-hmm. And you look at the cartoons from World War II by cartoonists in the UK or the US. And then you kind of can, it's the difference between understanding what was happening, what was being written about what was happening by the journalists, and what people were thinking about what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
The art in the political cartoon distilled the sort of opinion or the zeitgeist of what people were feeling about what was happening versus what was being written about, which was like, here's what happened today. That interpretation, again, if you study those same cartoons today in the context of, say, a Ukrainian hot war, and you know, or in the context of you know, social media, or mm-hmm. everyone being divided and having different ethics on, like, basic morals and ethics on certain things,
right?
You could come to understand just how flexible those interpretations are, and how right Jacques Derrida is in his sort of assessment of the fact that linguistically, but also just conceptually, things change with context and with time. It's probably part of the reason that we keep repeating a lot of history, we keep doing a lot of things and not learning from history, is that we build our own interpretations and then make the same mistakes, because intrinsically, that's just what we do as humans. I do a lot of work with Sam Harris, has an app called Waking Up.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things I work with him on are like the conversations section, illustrating the conversations section, but also something called the essential Sam Harris, which is trying to distill down certain ideas that are complex. It's really difficult to distill complex things down to really, digestible bites of information. So I do that with illustrations and cartoons, along with a team that puts those essential packages together in sort of a visual form, mm-hmm. as well as an audio form. So things like AI, morality, consciousness, violence, free will, belief, nuclear war, social media, information landscape, death,
all the big
spirituality,
words.
All the big ones, the real heavy, complex, divisive topics that are really difficult to distill, but the interpretations of them change based on even your exposure,
mm-hmm.
your information exposure. And as you know, sort of creativity can simply be bringing two disparate things together that haven't been combined before, but they were combined because they were both in your mind,
right.
Based on your exposure to them. So not to get too far into the weeds, but I do think a big piece of what we do as artists, not trying to be too high-minded about it, but is kind of interpreting our experience of our own consciousness as it pertains to our context in the world. So when you're sitting in a gallery and you're drawing some people that you see, it might look like just a little sketch of a thing, but your sort of micro observations of posture and how you interpret, you know, the way a fabric falls on someone's body, or how their shoes look on their feet, or, you know, even the way a shadow is cast on something.
Mm-hmm.
All of those little tiny things are your personal interpretation of your experience that I think build a distinct sort of unique value to your work. And yeah, that's one of the things that I enjoy about doing what we do is sort of sharing that, let's call it a version of existence, a version of interpretation of our existence.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I so agree. Like, especially with these really complicated subjects, I feel like the position of art and illustration by extension is a very interesting position. All my life, I have only wanted to be a writer. Ever since I knew that this is a job one can have, that these books that I read so voraciously They are written by a person, and that person can also be me. I can also just write. Ever since I learned this when I was very young, I only ever wanted to be a writer. So I have always had this reverence for words in my mind and in my life. I like to memorize slogans of brands. So that's a small manifestation. I would remember quotes from my favorite books and I would write them down because the words really matter to me. And today we are in a world where words have a have this strange importance where people think words are so powerless and irrelevant, but our daily existence is governed by them. Our interaction, our 90% of our interactions with other people are through the words that they write to us and we write to them through text. And then we are interpreting those texts. Like, textual communication is such an interesting thing that has happened to us that did not happen to any previous generation of humans. Because we are talking instantly and emotionally and using these emojis and using the various acronyms and using our own jargon and languages. And we are communicating by text. And then that text, as Derrida would look and smile and comment, is a lie, because now it's up to the interpretation of the other person. And there is no human-to-human connection in this, or, well, physical connection in this. And there is so much ample opportunity for misinformation and for simply being influenced in another direction, or misinterpretation. Because, you know, it's just words, and everybody is reading words in their own way and processing them in their own way. In this sort of situation, I love what art has sort of enabled me to do. It's taken a lot of time to understand it and then to empower myself to do it and then to respect what this thing is. Yeah. As a person who has loved words all his life, now to say that words are really sometimes so useless at doing the thing that they are supposed to do. Like, words are so bad at meaning things. And that's like the one job they have.
You have to put that on a mug. Words are so bad at meaning.
You can't get people. Yeah, and this is the same problem you have as a writer. You have it as a stand-up comic. You said this word, but now everybody's got a different thing in their head. And like, I use the word for a reason, guys. Like, but that's it. That's the problem. And so art comes in. And
yes,
art is this really fascinating thing. There are, as a society that is conditioned to giving words this enormous importance, we also tend to think that, so there's this common sentiment, you know, I like this painting, but I don't know what I like about it. And of course, you'll have people who love art who will say this, but also a lot of people who are, quote unquote, casually indulging. So a few months ago in March, I was in New York and I went to the MoMA for the first time in my life. And I walked up and down and up and down, and I did three circuits of the whole place. Fascinating. And one of the things I was doing in the, in these circuits was just observing the kinds of people who come to see modern art. And this was the question in my mind. Who comes to look at modern art?
Yeah.
And is it always people who know modern art and who appreciate art history and have a sense of what's what and what is it what in relation to something else? Or is it people who are here because this is one of those iconic New York places, you have to go, and it's an experience, just go without thinking too much? I was one of those people, like, I don't know a lot of art history, and I just wanted to see what I could see and see what would happen from it. So I was looking at these other people who, in my mind, were also in a similar place. And a lot of people in that situation would say that there's things I liked, but I don't know why I liked it. And therefore, it's probably not very good because I can't describe what I liked about it. And here's what I'm thinking. So coming back to the things that we're talking about, that we are so predisposed to words now. We think that if we can't put it in words, it's not real. Derrida would say there's nothing outside the text. So if you can't, if you can't find the words for it, it's probably not a real feeling. And if you can't describe it perfectly, then it's probably not real at all.
Right.
And this is where art comes in. Art, from the point of view of the creator, and then for all the succeeding years, months, decades, centuries, from the point of view of the people looking at it, is nonverbal communication. And it's got complexities, it's got stories, it's got protagonists and antagonists, and it's got drama and dynamics, but it doesn't have words.
Right.
All of these complexities are communicated without getting into this sad business of translating them into words and then translating them out of it again.
Yeah, this is what I hate about that little white thing under the painting. I really despise because I live in Chelsea on the west side of Manhattan. And every morning I walk the High Line, and at the bottom is the Whitney. And then up by me is about 50 different galleries full of all kinds of art. But the descriptions underneath them are so full of crap at trying to distill in words what the painting is about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always written by the artist. It's sometimes written by the gallerist to try and inflate its importance or value or context or whatever it is, which is so much of the art world is just like building in, sort of retroactively building in what the thing is rather than just letting it be.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about you, especially going to MoMA, and this is something, I mean, I love that you said that because I do that at the Met, and I go to watch the people, not the paintings, because I've seen seen the paintings, I've seen the textiles, I've seen the, the old sculptures and things, but I love seeing people react. That's my favorite part, watching people react to the art. And I lose days doing that. And when I'm at a comedy show, when I'm not on stage, like before I get on stage, I'm not watching the comedian. I'm watching the audience. I'm watching their reactions, because that to me is that if there is a text, that's what it is for me, is that's the information that I'm getting, is the reaction from them to what's happening on stage. And for you to kind of go to a gallery and watch people watching art, I know it sounds very meta and very, but it is, I think, certainly to me, I find that way more interesting than just looking at the art itself and knowing how it affects me and where I'm standing when I'm looking at it and how I feel looking at it today versus how I feel looking at it in a week from now or a year from now,
right,
in my own emotional context or whatever it is, or my age, I think that you're exactly right. It is a nonverbal form of communication that fills in the gap where words fail.
One of the other questions at MoMA to me was this, for these young people, for Gen Z, like I grew up with a phone also, but for Gen Z that is born in the thick of social media and all the corporations of the world throwing content at you all the time, to be born in this world, I feel like everyone has seen everything now in their screens. Like you can't really surprise anybody with anything. Nobody is ever in true awe of something else because they've always seen a version of something fantastical on a reel or a TikTok. And so nobody's really surprised by anything. So for me, the experience at the MoMA was also to a thinking about the generation that has seen everything on their phones already. What does this physical confrontation with art bring? And what are the things that are truly remarkable, but that they just walk past? Because a lot of realist art, a lot of, like, say, Renoir, or even a lot of painters from Rembrandt, for example, people who are very realistic and who did this incredible job and were revolutionary in many ways, but their art is so ubiquitous and it's become such a part of pop culture or generally in media, it has been memeified. Actually, memeified is nice. Like it's like mummified because it has been preserved.
Yeah, memeified versus mummified.
But we've kind of made a different version of it as a meme. So how they relate to something, and if it's memeified, then do they give it a second glance? And then what do they stop at? And what makes them suddenly look again, like something that they haven't already seen in their devices? And something that has a, you know, that's stopping in the middle of like a carousel that you are on in a museum, usually in a packed museum. The act of stopping is a genuine reaction. So I wanted to see, where do they stop? And is it always like the famous painter, or is it someone random, so to say, random, like someone they don't know at all, someone I don't know at all, someone who isn't a meme? that makes them stop? Or is it always something popular? And these reactions are so much more genuine to me, at least to me, than those of an art historian, because too much knowledge, like, I think, comes in the way of free contemplation. So this is a phrase that I read and understood and absorbed recently, the importance of free contemplation of art. So not having those little white boxes, like you say, which tell you why he did this, what he did, and when and how. And instead, to just look at the art as an experience, and in that experience to go somewhere with it, not necessarily curated or defined or guided by the museum.
That is interesting. I think the relationship people have with the medium that they see whatever they see on is becoming more essential than it ever has before. When you used to go to a museum or a gallery, it because it was curated by someone deliberately, mm-hmm. and it was curated for a public. Whereas now, your algorithmic curation of what you see, it's literally tailored to your brain, and ever more, it gets ever more accurate as to what it knows you like. So as you say, people just strolling past a Renoir or a Jeff Koons or whatever it is that they like, they sort of told that they should enjoy or like, while they've got their TikTok open. I think it's a different relationship that people have to the authority of the medium. So a museum wall is a very deliberate attempt to share a thing with people, and getting back to what we started talking about, which is the reaction doesn't belong to you. Everyone will have a different interpretation of the piece, a different reaction. Hopefully they don't take too much of the interpretation that's written in the little thing as, you know, as the canon, as the thing that it absolutely is or isn't. But then, you know, I have to really come to grips with the fact that, and I'm reluctant to, but I have to just accept that the phone screen is the new museum wall. It's the new mm-hmm. canvas that people have to, they have, you're right, Gen Z and incoming generations who are digital natives, they do have a trust for what they see on that screen. That sort of black mirror canvas is their museum wall. So their interpretation of value is different. And I think that's something that when I look at things online, I too wonder, like, who else is seeing this? I wonder who else is getting this stuff in their feed. I wonder if they're making of it the same thing that I am. I wonder how they're interpreting it, because yeah, that's the ubiquity of a smartphone. Everyone has it now.
Oh yes. Like, I was talking with one of my colleagues, and he's a really popular artist on Instagram and TikTok. And we spoke about how an overwhelmingly large percentage of our audience is only ever going to see our work through the screen. They are never going to physically see my sketchbook. They might never ever see my paintings or my drawings on a wall somewhere. They will always only see me through the screen. So it's important to understand this, because in so many ways, especially if you're an independent artist or creator of any kind, the thing on the screen is the product. So we were thinking about reels, and we were thinking about how the drawing I make that day and how good it is or how beautiful it is, blah, blah, blah. Those things are not really relevant, because if the product is on the screen, then the product is not the finished drawing in my sketchbook. The product is the reel that I make. The picture that I take with the drawing and the subject in the back of it and the filter that I put on it, that is the art. And the drawing, the act, quote unquote, the actual art, is just the means to make the real art, which is happening on everybody's screens. So we're going to talk about comics again in a little bit, and we're going to talk about stand-up a little later, but I want to sort of join the two right now, because this question just occurred to me. Do you have to think about this differently with respect to your comics, your writing, and your stand-up? Like, how people are digitally going to receive it and out of context, so to speak?
Yeah, I think about it a lot because I've actually had some instances where it's been taken out of context and then posted. And then people will interpret it sort of erroneously. And when I say erroneously, I realize that that's in stark contradiction to the reaction doesn't belong to you. But when something purposefully taken out of context and then displayed like a clip of stand-up or that's within the context of a larger, chunk of material, or one panel of a comic strip without the context of the setup of the first panel or the last panel, it kind of gets into your brain. How could this be misinterpreted? How could this be misused? Like in the way that someone, accidentally treads on toes or on a thermonuclear topic 40 years ago in a graphic novel, and all of a sudden that page gets a photo, someone takes a photo of them, puts it on Twitter, and all of a sudden they're getting buried alive and canceled on Twitter because of something they wrote 40 years ago that is, interpreted differently now. Mm-hmm. Again, getting back to Derrida, that's another thing that just happens now is with comedy, especially because comedy, I think Jerry Seinfeld was saying that like roughly every 20 years, what is funny to a community, to an audience there is an entropy to a joke.
I see.
It does change. So whilst the fundamentals of like the mechanics of comedy don't change, mm-hmm. like why something works as a joke, like the structure, that doesn't change. The topics and the things that are funny and why they're funny, they do change. And you do have to sort of consider that. And when people are watching, like, I don't know if you've noticed in the past few years, especially, and especially since the prevalence of TikTok and Reels on Instagram and Facebook, is instead of posting their material online, comedians will post crowd work. That's like the big thing now is instead of burning your material, it's called burning your material. If you put it online, it means you can't record it on a special.
That's true.
Yeah. So you don't want to burn your material. Mm-hmm. You want to just show crowd work clips that kind of illustrate what your act is, what your voice is, why you are different than every other comedian, but also like your reaction to an audience member is a perfect illustration of like what your take is when someone yells out something about, being dyslexic. Okay. What do you got for that? And so you see comedians, the great examples like Phil Hanley. Is a great, as far as crowd work goes, Sam Morril, they're some of the best sort of joke writers, but they're also outstanding at being able to interact with an audience and it go on the screen, the phone screen, and go kind of viral because they just have that skill and it works quite well for that medium, for TikTok and Instagram and Reels, because it's spontaneous and it's unscripted. And it's not rehearsed. It's not something they wrote and rehearsed a million times. It's something they're just coming up with in the moment. And there's something very real and dangerous about that. It's like watching someone draw live. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to watch him make a mistake any minute now.
It's a moment of quote unquote reality in a otherwise scripted set. Because otherwise he's got a 5 minute or a 10 minute set. Mm-hmm. But then there's this interruption and now they're dealing with it. And like, what's also interesting about it is, I think because there is a sense of a confrontation, like a lot of the popular videos are how somebody handled a heckler or how somebody handled somebody who had opposite views. So especially political comics get this a lot.
Yeah.
And this confrontation I'm always thinking about the dynamics of social media. And to me, it appears like putting a confrontation, like sharing a reel or a TikTok of a confrontation allows people to take one or the other side. And as soon as they take one or the other side, you've got them as an audience. And it leads to more viral TikToks. Like, I feel like a lot of people do this because I'd never thought about your point about burning material, because that is also super relevant to this. But I feel like this kind of confrontational stuff is very, very, very topical and useful because of how social media works. So like you were saying, people design their own feeds and everybody thinks that their feed is their feed and it's exactly tailored to them and they have made it happen that way.
Mm.
And the business of consuming content on your phone, whether it's news or whether it's something viral or a reel or whatever, comedy, versus newspapers and televisions, and it's given to you. Like, I think the fundamental difference is also this sense of self and me wanting, me getting what I want right now and not something else. Yeah. Every moment of the day, every day of the week, I only want exactly what I want. And if I'm not, I don't like this in this moment, I'm going to swipe away, or I'm going to close the app, or I'm going to comment adversely to it, or I'm going to dislike it if I can, or downvote it if I can.
Yeah.
And this is a dynamic that's, I don't know how I feel about it. I feel like there is so much liberation here from both the audience side and from the creator side. But there's also a sense of now needing to cater to the maximum likes. We're getting derailed to something else that I was thinking about. Let's go back to what I was asking you about. Just as a stand-up comedian, do you think about moments, like, has it changed your act to think that something might need to be a reel or a TikTok video?
So I made a very conscious decision not to do that, not to put up clips of my act or my stand. And I do shows all the time where I do crowd work and I do interact with the audience. In fact, there's a show that I do called Picture This. It's a monthly show. We do one in LA and one in New York every month. And we have cartoonists backstage on a drawing tablet, drawing what the comedians on stage are talking about. And they interact with it. And it's very spontaneous and interactive. And it's closer to almost like an improv show than a stand-up show. But I don't post those clips because I do feel that there is an enormous value in something being in the room. There is this sort of unspoken consensus among a group of strangers in the dark that they all laughed at the same thing at the same time, but it was in the context of them being there then at that time. And whilst there are comedians who do fantastic clips that go viral and they do very well online, there is the sinister side of it, where it can go very, very badly. A friend of mine, I feel like even saying she's a friend is going to get me buried. Jocelyn Chia, she and I work together on a lot of things. And I've known her for a long time. And she had a part of a joke that was part of a larger piece go viral on TikTok. And now the Malaysian government want her to be arrested.
Oh, wow.
It's got, if you Google Jocelyn Chia, like, it literally, the Guardian and the New York Times comes up as her being canceled for this joke.
Oh, damn.
It's not even a good joke. Like, Chia,
it's not even a good joke.
I think she's annoyed because it's not even her best stuff. Like, right. If you're going to get canceled for a joke, you want it to be a closing
Oh, potentially
joke.
Arrested.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So it's really escalated to an international incident. But I very deliberately go away from that. And I also feel, and the reason I also avoid it is that something that I'm kind of a broken record with friends of mine, creative friends of mine on social media about this. And the central tenet of it is don't curate your art to what gets likes. Curate it to what you like.
Mm-hmm.
And people will find you. If you create the thing that you really like and naturally like, A, people will notice that you passionately like it, and they're drawn to people who are passionate about something, like, organically, not artificially passionate. And B, you'll just find your people. Your people will, as I know it's frustrating because it takes time, it's a slow process, but your people will find you in that sort of sea of brains just all floating around. That very slim sliver of the pie graph, you know, in comedy, in cartooning, in writing, all of it, you sort of end up becoming a magnet for those people. And then they build a community around your ideas and your voice, right? So instead of trying to be everything to everyone, which is impossible, so it's like being a perfectionist. It's just an unattainable goal. You end up sort of doubling down on what it is that you really enjoy and why you enjoy it, and then just kind of do that thing and stop noticing if you get a certain amount of likes or comments on one particular thing, because you'll be very, very tempted to just keep doing that one thing.
Right.
And then, you know, go down that path. And it may not be, look, it may be what you like, and that could be a good thing, but it may not be the thing that you're really meant to be doing. You're doing that artificially based on what's getting boosted on the algorithm, not what is fulfilling to you.
So I 100% agree with this. Like, I have written about it and I have spoken about it, and I tell people all the time that this is unfortunately what social media incentivizes.
Yeah,
you are exactly. boosted in the algorithm if you are a predictable experience, if you are the same thing every time.
Yep.
And the way people use social media, like even human behavior, is, again, you know, you're in their social media, you're in their world, even if it's your account. And when they come to your account, they kind of want a certain thing from you. And if they like your account, they have the expectation that you will give them that thing again, that feeling, that the emotion, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
And this will push you towards a box. But you have to you have to avoid these boxes, because the idea of being creative does not work if you sit inside a box doing the same thing again and again. So there's this thing I learned from somebody. It's a principle of economics, and I had to sort of rejig it to fit to social media and to being an artist. It's called Goodhart's Law. Is there any chance you've heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so this is a good one. You like it. What it says is, when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a useful measure.
Wow, that's good. So, that is good.
Yeah, so let's think about social media. So your social media following as a measure of how good you are or how popular you are. When this number of your following becomes a target for you to reach, it ceases to be a useful measure of those other things, your popularity or how good you are. Because once it's a target, you think, I have to reach 100,000 followers. You're going to do all of these things to reach 100,000 followers. You could, for example, give money to Mark Zuckerberg to promote your account. Mm-hmm. And if you run ads on Instagram enough, you will acquire lots and lots of followers. But a lot of those followers, for example, in Facebook's case, are going to be bots, because Mark Zuckerberg is a crook. And so therefore, you will have a lot of followers, but you don't actually have a lot of followers. So this measure of how good you are or how popular you are is no more a useful measure, because the data is polluted with all these things that are other than your popularity or your goodness. Another nice contrast was, say, during COVID, for example, some parts of India, some states in India set a target of zero COVID. And now the COVID numbers are no longer a measure of public health, because how do you get zero COVID? Just make it difficult for people to get tests. So suddenly you don't have the same COVID numbers, but now the COVID numbers that you do have are no longer useful for anything. They are no longer a useful measure of how the country is doing, how the state is doing, whether people are healthy or unhealthy, because they just can't get the tests.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, the metrics changed when the algorithm decided to suppress static posts and elevate video posts like reels. I have friends who have literally, some of them, like 4 million people following them, and they can only access maybe 1,000 of those at any given time with a post, because they post comics, static comics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're on paper, it looks amazing. Mm-hmm. And a publisher would see that and go, what are your stats? And as you know, every time when you're pitching a book, one of the first questions they ask, and I really despise this, but it's a truth of the publishing industry, is they go, are you verified on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram?
Mm-hmm.
Are you on TikTok? Because what if we could get you to go viral on BookTok? Are you how many followers do you have? Because so much of the onus is on the author, the creator, to actually promote the book through their network. But the problem is, as I say, you know, you could have 4 million followers, but your ability to actually reach those 4 million followers is entirely governed by the platform that it's on and the algorithm dictating it. So it's why I've always been such a staunch proponent of newsletters going way back. I started a MailChimp newsletter many years ago when I was doing stand-up to try and get audiences to come to shows.
Right.
So I'd stand at the door after the show and I'd hand out a business card with my, I'm such a nerd, with my MailChimp mailing list, a QR code and a link.
Oh, I have a QR code on my business card as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have one now for my Substack, but I hide them all over New York. I sort of leave them at bars and in bathrooms and things. It's weird, but
oh, someone might confuse it for a menu, maybe.
Oh, I definitely put them in the check. You know, when the check comes and there's a little booklet, I put it in there for sure. And I put them in a couple of menus here or there. Okay. Once in a while, there'll be like an art book shop. And there'll be books about New York and I'll like split my card in New York cartoons.
That's just sneaky.
Because I'm like, well, that's your audience. So
I need to do that now. I'm gonna take that idea. I'm gonna do this all over Vancouver. Just leave
it's like,
things.
It's like a pirate, I'm probably breaking some kind of law, but I don't know. But that sort of direct connection that you have with newsletter readers versus people who opted in. They didn't hit follow. They didn't click follow. They actually opted in and entered their email address and they confirmed. They said, yes, I want to hear from you. And if your open rate is anywhere near 50%, which is very good, then you're doing way better than the guy with 4 million followers on Instagram who's hitting, you know, getting 1,000 responses from his 4 million followers. And I think that that is the truth of what's sort of coming with, you know, one post could get 10 million views on TikTok and then the next post might get 5.
Absolutely.
Because going viral on something like TikTok doesn't necessarily mean that your account goes viral and blows up. It means that post goes viral and it may be, or even maybe it's just the comment section of one particular post goes turbo nuclear, but then everything else you've ever posted gets totally ignored.
Oh yeah.
So I don't think it's an accurate metric of success or popularity. I also don't think it's a particularly useful metric when publishers sort of come to you and say, your book idea is great, but how many social media followers do you have? Because otherwise we're not going to have the conversation.
Right.
I just don't think it's a useful metric anymore. Maybe once upon a time it was, but I just don't think anymore it is a useful metric of the success of an idea or your ability to disseminate that idea to your people.
Yeah, very, very true. And I think a lot of brands are rising up to this as well, because like, I feel like a lot of brands now, they don't just look at this number of followers because they know that can be purchased. They look at engagement and they look at how active your comments are. And like, as soon as, you know, people who are putting money into these things start to look at different metrics, you know that the previous metrics are not useful anymore. So let's go back in time now. I want to go back to before the acquired wisdom from all the experiences to how you started to be a cartoonist. And you live in Perth, you lived in Perth, Australia, which I know is in Western Australia because of the cricket ground.
the Wacker. Yeah.
The Wacker. And I also know it's a very difficult venue to win at. Speaking of cricket, by the way, condolences for the Ashes. I'm really sad to see how it went down.
Thank you.
I have hated Australian cricketers for many, many years. I have had very strong feelings about them and antagonistic feelings, but the current English cricket team really has turned me into a diehard Australian supporter.
More people in Australia could name the entire Australian cricket team than who is prime minister right now. it is the national sport in the way that I guess baseball is the national sport in America.
Yeah.
Although football is very quickly, you know, surpassing baseball. Perth was and is, I love Perth. It's a beautiful city. It's basically a town parading as a city. It's a beautiful place. I've heard people say that it's a great place to be a baby and have a baby and not a lot in between. And by that, I mean, if you want to have a career in, say, the creative arts or be surrounded by the best in the industry to challenge you to sort of increase your skill or knowledge level or ability, this isn't an elitist thing. This is purely just by virtue of, you know, this is what happens. People concentrate in epicenters like London and New York and LA. And, you know, the people gravitate towards each other, towards the best of what the thing they want to do. So it's why actors go to LA. It's why, you know, bankers go to London and New York. And tech people go to San Francisco. It just is what it is. And so Perth is the most isolated capital city in the world. It's also a huge advantage. I consider myself very lucky that I grew up in Perth. There's a great acting school there called WAFA, the WA Academy of Performing Arts. It's where Hugh Jackman went and a lot of big actors like Heath Ledger and people like that. Because you get to kind of practice in the quiet and the solitude of a place that isn't a sort of bustling, you know, humming hive of what have you got next? What have you got? What have you got? You know, it's right. Like, it's a quiet, slow paced, you know, it's parochial, I guess, but it's also, you make your mistakes in the dark while less people are watching. I wouldn't say, well, nobody's watching, because the internet is what it is. Mm-hmm. And there are still people in Perth. Like, they have fantastic comedy festivals and theater, fantastic theater there, great music. But it's definitely a place to hone your craft
right
before you take it out into the world. Oh. So I thought, for me, although there weren't a lot of cartoonists there, there were like two working cartoonists in all of Perth, and they're still there doing the exact same job. And it's been nearly 40 years since, you know, they started doing those jobs. I did think that at the time, as frustrated as I was to just get out into the world and start doing things, what I realized is I was very lucky that I was honing my craft in the sort of like the sandbox. It's funny, West Australians are called sand gropers because everything on WA is a beach, like best beaches in the whole world. If you like surfing, that's where you live. Mm-hmm. But it is a sandbox. It is kind of this place where you can make your mistakes and make sort of, you can grow and you can experiment and you can do things that you might not ordinarily be willing to do because you're worried that, you know, if you're in New York, someone might see it and think, oh, well, that's the thing he does.
Right.
And first impressions last. So,
yeah.
You know, you're not making a lot of first impressions in Perth with big, you know, like agents and managers and art directors,
right,
and people like that. So, I think Perth as a cartoonist, really, really difficult to make a living in Perth as a cartoonist unless, mm-hmm, you know, you're like a giant name that doesn't need to be anywhere to work and can just sell your
books.
Yeah,
if your geography is irrelevant.
Yeah, if the geography is irrelevant, it's a beautiful place to live. If you need to be in a place to do a thing, it's really tough. Yeah, there are very few people who can. I mean, there are some who do, but it's very difficult to make a living doing that thing from that place. Often you have to leave to do that thing. So there's a huge, what they call, you know, the brain drain. There's a lot of people moving to Melbourne and Sydney and then overseas to try and actually work in their craft in such a way that they can make a living doing it, rather than having a side hustle. You know, having like a full-time job or a part-time job and then having their passion as a side hustle.
Yeah. Or even like a big place like Fountain Lakes, Victoria. Do you know about Fountain Lakes, Victoria?
I've heard of Fountain Lakes, yeah.
It's a thriving town that I know about because of one of my favorite sitcoms.
Oh, Kath and Kim.
Kath and Kim.
Yeah.
But so tell me a little bit about just this path to becoming a cartoonist. Like at 23, you're taking over Ginger Meggs, which is such a massive responsibility. And I'm so curious about what you did in the lead up to this that got you this job. So tell me a little bit about growing up in Perth and the kind of comics and the kind of influences that pushed you towards expressing yourself. This was part one of my conversation with Jason Chatfield. Thank you so much for listening. Up next is part two. To be part of the conversation or make a joke about the Australian cricket team, join over 10,000 readers of my Substack newsletter, almost exclusively devoted to making fun of the Australian cricket team. Link in the episode description. Thank you to the wonderful people that support this show via Substack, my Australian cricket team hating Substack publication. I do all the work around this show myself, from booking guests to producing the episode and even framing these words that I'm saying right now.
None of it would be possible without the support of Sneaky Art Insiders, including some based in Australia. Thank you again, and I look forward to seeing you in the next one.